Okay. Thank you for coming back. Round of four. Partial satisfaction of performance obligations prior to identifying contract. Paper number 33. Stuart's going to take us through this.
Okay, thank you. Entities sometimes begin activities on a contract before they've either finalised all the contract terms or perhaps before the detailed criteria for recognising revenue and the standard are satisfied. For instance, collectability. Commencing before that is basically just a fact of business in quite a lot of sectors. And in the paper, we call the point when the paragraph 9 criteria for recognising revenue are satisfied. We call it the contract establishment date, or CED for short. And there are two questions that have arisen, which the paper addresses. The first question is, how do you recognise revenue for activities before the contract establishment date? And we had two alternatives proposed to us. The first one, alternative A, is effectively a cumulative catch-up, and it's on the basis that some of the performance obligations have actually been satisfied at the CED. The alternative B, is that you would recognise revenue prospectively from the CED, and that's on the basis that performance obligations only came into existence when the contract came into existence for the purposes of IFRS 15 at CED, and therefore could only be satisfied prospectively from that point. The staff's view is that alternative A, cumulative catch-up, most faithfully embodies the principle in the standard that revenue should be recognised to depict the transfer of promised goods or services to customers. We think if, say, 30% of the activities of the contract are completed at the CED, it's a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the standard that at that point, 30% of the performance obligations have been satisfied. We think if there are two identical contracts where activity by the entity is the same, but at the outset one doesn't satisfy the criteria for recognition of revenue, then the pattern of revenue recognition after the CED should still be the same. An alternative A achieves this, an alternative B doesn't achieve this. So that's our rationale. The second question is, how do you account for fulfillment costs incurred before the contract establishment date? And here we have three alternatives proposed. The first one, A, is you would capitalise and then effectively adopt a cumulative catch-up method. You expense at the CED if the costs relate to activities before the CED, and you amortise the remainder over the period of transfer of the remaining goods or services. Alternative B is that you would capitalise them, but you would then amortise them prospectively as the entity transfers the remaining goods or services to the customer. And the third alternative, C, is that you would expense them as they're incurred. The staff's view is essentially that view A is appropriate. Looking at them slightly out of order, view B is really only consistent with view B in the first issue, which we don't think is appropriate. So we don't think view B is appropriate when accounting for the costs. That leaves views A and C. And the staff do not consider, under the standard, the costs were incurred in satisfying performance obligations for accounting purposes before the contract came into existence. As I said before, we think performance obligations are satisfied on a cumulative catch-up basis at the CED, and we think the pattern of cost recognition should also reflect this. Alternative A achieves this, and alternative C does not achieve this. However, I think it's important to temper this with a note of caution. This analysis is only relevant to fulfilment costs under IFRS 15. Some costs may require to be capitalised under a different standard, and you also have to look at all the provisions of IFRS 15. So immediate expense may be appropriate if, say, their general and administration costs, which aren't chargeable to the customer, or their costs of wasted materials or labour, or not recoverable in some other way. That's obviously a very high-level summary of the issues and the staff's analysis, so I will turn it over to you for comments.
Thank
Carl.
Thanks. Agree the way for both questions. I think it was very well articulated. Congratulations for the night.
James.
I think on issue one, in view A, provided of course that control of the goods or services happens at the date the contract is signed, then a cumulative catch-up would be most appropriate for issue one. However, with issue two, we, in discussing this, I think we ruled out UA because we did not believe there was a contract in place, and unless it meets the criteria of another standard such as IS2, etc., we didn't believe that you could get into UA. And we settled for view C, probably. The issue around view C, though, is what is meant by an anticipated contract? Because you may qualify for capitalization of these fulfillment costs prior to the actual contract being signed, but after you had commenced work on these particular performance obligations.
So I think there's a sort of scope question here that's quite important. And the examples that the paper uses, I think, both focus on construction of things that are physical assets and are presumably qualified for revenue over time under paragraph 35C. And if we are limiting this discussion to things that are physical assets that qualify for revenue recognition over time under paragraph 35C, then I think we're comfortably in view A for both questions. And one of the reasons for saying this is that if you think about the apartment block scenario, which I think, to me this is one of the more compelling arguments, if you have effectively pre-sold a proportion of those apartments and concluded that the customers that signed up prior to construction, for those contracts you're recognising revenue over time, it's very hard to see when someone else comes along and signs up when you're 37% complete, how they are in any different position from the people that signed up originally. And in particular, if you've concluded that those customers that signed up initially actually control this physical asset, which you have concluded under paragraph 35C, it seems very hard to reach a different view that the people that signed up partway through don't similarly control the equivalent assets that they've now signed up for. So for contracts that are under 35C for physical assets, I think I'm pretty happy with this. I would be very cautious about generalising from that to other scenarios because I think it may be much less obvious that there is an asset that for which control is now automatically with the customer. So I think other scenarios might need more careful thought. And I'm sorry, I didn't notice from the paper whether it was deliberately limited to 35C or not, but I would personally limit it to 35C.
You make the observation based on whether control passes or not in circumstances of other things. So a consulting contract, for instance, where you've done some of the work prior to being given the contract.
See, for me, the some of the difficulties are potentially deciding which activities seem like they are part of what we're seeing as the overall contract. Now, in the case of construction, I think we know that those construction type contract is typically a single performance obligation. Different bits of it can't be distinct. So when you've got somebody signing up at the point that you're 37% complete, I think it's fairly clear that the work that's been done to date is part of that thing, and therefore is something that, for which control is being transferred. I think in a consulting contract it might be less obvious that the work that's been done to date is part of
I
that
guess
thing.
The
Maybe it would be sometimes.
Yeah, the example, I think, you know, you put a lot of effort into a proposal, and in fact you do a reasonable amount of the work to get a proposal put together. And then if you win the job, you've only got 66% to do. And I would have thought that would be okay.
I think it might well be. I'm just cautious, because I think there might be some circumstances where, rather than saying the work you've done so far is clearly part of a bigger performance obligation, you might actually believe the work you've done so far is simply not part of the contract.
Right.
The contract is just the stuff you're going to do in the future. I don't think that argument works for physical things. But I think it might work for
I don't understand why it's physical versus non-physical. Because I think even if you perform before the contract, the conditions that it needs to be directly for the contract to qualify for capitalization would need to be met. But I can imagine that this can be for good or service that doesn't jump the hurdles for being over time versus point in time. So, and I don't know whether physical or intangible would make a difference here.
It only makes a difference to me in the sense that for physical things, I feel comfortable saying I definitely agree with you, Ray. For non-physical things, I want to give it a bit more thought.
Is it more about that the judgment is harder figuring out whether these are actually a cost that relate to fulfilling the performance obligation? So it's also that you disagree with the analysis of the question. It's just actually figuring all the facts and circumstances is a little hard.
Yes, I think that's right. So I think it's easy to see the activities that went into building an apartment block. It's maybe less obvious that certain activities have gone into some other intangible thing that they may or may not have done.
Brian.
So I think I'm going to echo a bit of Phil's caution and in particular pick up on James' reference to transfer of control. Without objecting to the accounting under VUA in lots of circumstances, I'd like to think that what it reflected was an actual transfer of control on contract inception. So there's a bit of language in the paper, or the title of the paper is about partial satisfaction of performance obligations prior to having a contract. And before you have a contract, I'm not sure if you have to have a performance obligation. And also, is cumulative catch-up the right phrase? Well, if what I'm depicting is the transfer that occurs on the contract coming into being, I don't think that's necessarily a cumulative catch-up. I think it's revenue because I've transferred something at that time. So I'd rather come at this question as to whether or not there is a transfer on the date the contract comes into existence, rather than thinking about this as going back into history and recharacterising activities that I previously thought of in a different way. So I suspect for many of the real estate fact patterns, it would be very, very clear that there is a transfer on contract inception date, and in some of the jurisdictions that we've had to deal with under Country 15, the transfer will be proportionate to the state of completion at that point in time. But as Phil says, there could be other circumstances where going back and recharacterising what we've done in the past would possibly be a good outcome. But I also think one of...
There wasn't an intention that in the paper that you would go back and recharacterise these costs.
That's great.
I mean, the reference to identifying the contract, that's purely for the purpose of IFRS 15, the paragraph 9 criteria. We did have a longer title, but it got pruned because it wouldn't fit.
I'm all for short titles. I guess what I'm saying is I'd like the data entry to be tied into an actual transfer of control, which will then help me probably with the cost question, because I won't have in my balance sheet anymore if I've transferred it to my customer.
Why do you think it's not a transfer of control? I mean, the principle, there has to be a transfer of control, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, if we're all agreed on that, then perhaps I'm only making...
There's going to be difficult in some cases to know what's been transferred.
I think, Brian, you're trying to just link the logic perhaps more strongly to the basis, which I think is touched on in paragraph 21 of the staff paper, in the sense of saying, you're doing this cumulative catch-up effect, because effectively that does depict, under the contract that you now have, some effectively initial performance under that contract. And it's reflecting the transfer of control of goods and services to the customer at that point.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I think I understand your concern about, you know, partially satisfying performance obligations of contract inception and can catch up. It's just trying to find some way of describing what's going on.
Danny?
I support the principle behind the conclusions in the staff paper. I understand that there might be challenges in some circumstances identifying what has actually transferred. But I think that is a practical question about identifying what has transferred rather than any concern about the principle. I think when it comes to costs, it's, I would say, much the same. I think the key with costs is to go to other standards first. And again, it's easy if you're in the real estate example because it would be inventory for the most part. You wouldn't need to worry about whether it was a fulfillment cost. I think the perhaps added wrinkle with fulfillment costs is if you're going to capitalise them beforehand, you just need to understand the reason why you haven't met the definition of a contract to start with. So if it's because there's some uncertainty about getting paid, so you failed the probable threshold, would you be able to pass the probable of recovery threshold? So it just, again, I agree with the staff saying apply the principle and the standard. They're just light in some circumstances. If you don't have a physical asset that's inventory, you might then struggle to say, well, is this probable of being recovered? Because I failed probable of recovery in step one. But again, follow the principle.
I think in the consulting one, again, you could, because sometimes these proposals take 6 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. You put in a lot of work, you have a balance state in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. You've got a 1 chance in 10 of winning the contract at that stage. What do you do with the costs? Well, generally you write them off. And then when you finally do win, how far do you go back and what do you gather up?
There's probably some questions of detailed application in there that step beyond the scope of this discussion.
And then that begs the question of what are you transferring the control of that? Okay. Andrew.
Thanks. On the first one part, I'm really consistent with others, pretty firmly in view A, that there would be a cumulative catch-up reflecting the what you transfer control on at that point. Also, again, echoing Tony, rather bearing in mind that for some things, in particular intangibles, it might be a bit tricky to work out exactly what's been transferred, but that's separate from what you're actually trying to apply. When you get onto fulfillment costs, because you don't have a contract up to that point, it seems quite difficult to get completely into view A. And I think that we rather drifted more towards view C, that if you haven't got a contract yet, it's difficult to pay the 15, so you need to find another home for those costs, which may be fairly straightforward for certain contracts, it may be a bit harder for others.
Any other thoughts?
No.
Well, where do we end up there? This is question one. Well, we're dealing with both.
We do both. We have a diversity of comments on both.
I think I heard that most people would veer towards view A with some hesitation, and that's to do with thinking about if there's a transfer of control, what's transferred, and if there are fulfillment costs, what are they?
Yeah, and the point is slightly different. I think people were happy with the principle in view A,
okay. But
there's then an application question, which is that in some circumstances it might be difficult to figure out what has actually transferred.
Right.
So it's the principle is fine, but it's not as straightforward always as
I think that's what I said, transfer control. What's transferred is a difficult question. Yeah. But also, I think the fulfillment costs might be hard to gather as well. So what do we do about that? Do we recommend that there should be a lengthy dissertation on how you assess what's transferred?
We could do nothing in the basis there's enough guidance.
Yeah. Well, it is in relation, fulfillment costs are in relation to an anticipated contract. So I think where Andrew and I were coming from was that we were feeling quite uncomfortable because there is no contract, but the words are anticipated, which could indicate there's a point where you believe you can start accumulating these fulfillment costs, assuming you cannot find a home for them somewhere else. And that's possibly a judgmental error.
Okay. You can always write them off.
That's yes, you could.
But
I can't work on the premise that because I'm accumulating something in IS2 as inventory, which will be transferred when I enter into the contract, necessarily that I will be accumulating all fulfillment costs.
No. That was where I was alluding to, really, differently with fulfillment costs. You may have been forced to write a lot of them up because you have a balance that
I will have, yes.
Do you dig them up again? Or do you...
I don't think so. Once written off, they're written off.
But if you prefer to, then you can carry them forward.
Yeah, but if you're at the stage where you don't know if you prefer it better or not, then a balance date comes up.
On balance, you would say they're irrecoverable.
So you write them off. So the bit you transferred on control wouldn't include everything you'd spent.
No.
It would include the bits that are still sitting there.
No, that's the sort of point I was trying to make in a shorthand way in the last paragraph.
Okay. Now, is anybody discontent with my summing up? Because these things aren't easy to sum up. If you've got any suggestions as to what I should add or subtract, that would be good to hear.
Just clarify what you said. It's a 0-1 situation, would you write off everything or you would take only that which you're recognizing revenue and still capitalize the remaining?
Yeah, I think your second point.
The second point, right.
Okay.